You know, I was a guy who took staplers. You know, I never got paid what I was worth. I don't know if anybody else is it. I had talents that the people I worked for never understood. They never saw. It amazed me. I told them about them. But even after I brought it to their attention, they didn't see it. So I did what any normal person would do. I stole from them. And my favorite thing was staplers. Now, you know, if you work a lot, you might wear out one stapler in a lifetime. I've got 10 staplers. 9 of them never used. And I'd take a stapler. That would show them. And then, you know, and I was sober, and I'm packing up my desk at the place where they gave me an education. They put up with my drunkenness. They put up with my early sobriety. And I find myself taking their stapler. And I said, oh, that's right. I don't take staplers anymore. And I had to take it out and put it back. Now, it'd been a lot easier if it never occurred to me to take the stapler. You know? But I wasn't yet there. See? And that's what the sixth step is. Sixth step is a process where I do it the old way and then stop myself and say, I don't do it that way anymore. They don't owe me. I owe them. I owe them a debt of gratitude I could never pay. I love what they did for me. I didn't know, but the chairman of my department at that time was sober 10 years. I never knew. He went to meetings someplace out in Virginia. I never saw him. I never knew that stuff. He never told me. And I never thought to ask. Two or three other members of the were alcoholics. I was sober 3 months. I think this is worth saying, too. I was sober 3 months. And I began to wonder, you know, 3 months is a dangerous time. We didn't have chips where I got sober. They were invented. They really started in North Carolina. But they didn't have them in the Washington, D.C. area, so I didn't have a red chip. But I love the idea of a red chip being dangerous, because in 3 months, I began to reconsider my position. I began to say things like, well, maybe I'm really not an alcoholic. I mean, they're just a bunch of unprofessionals. I mean, I'm running around in a white coat, right? Not the kind that wraps around. I mean, this is the kind that, had my name and everything on them. And so I'm thinking, I mean, I'm getting pretty cool again and pretty smart. And I'm thinking maybe I was a bit precipitous with this lifetime business. And so I there was a psychiatrist there. I said, well, I'm going to go check it out with Bill. Now, Bill had a free clinic down on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And I would go with him to do genetic testing. That's what I did in those days. And we'd talk on the way down and back and stuff. And he'd always thank me for my time. And he was a real nice guy, and I knew that he would see me and probably wouldn't charge me. That was real important, too. And so I stopped by to see Bill, and I told Bill, I said, you got a few minutes I need to talk to you. He said, of course, come in. So I sat down, and I told him, I said, you know, 3 months ago, I said, I went into treatment for alcoholism, and I said, and I went on to him. He said, well, what about AA? I said, well, I go 10 times a week. He said, well, that's good. That's really good. And I said, but... I said, do you think I'm doing the right thing? And he said, well, do you want to kill yourself? And I said, no. And he said, are you able to get to work? I said, yeah. He said, you couldn't do that before? I said, no, I couldn't. So he went on. He began to point out some subtle changes that had taken place in my life. And then I said to him, do you think that I ought to keep doing this? And he said, well, it seems to be working better than what you were doing before. And I couldn't argue that, so he confirmed it, and I left. Do you know the man I chose to go see was a non-alcoholic member of the board of Alcoholics Anonymous? Now, does God take care of me or does God take care of me? You know? I sober 7 or 8 years and I'm down in New Orleans and there he is. Bill, what are you doing here? He said, and every year I'd go back, you know, on my anniversary and we'd have a cup of coffee and laugh about the fact I was thinking about resigning when I was sober 90 days. So it's very, very important, I think, that we... see this process and this change that happens, and at the sixth step is a process where I do it wrong. You know? The old idea I had was if I just knew what was wrong, I wouldn't do it anymore because I'm that kind of guy. I mean, I'm a good guy, so if I know it's wrong, I won't do it. My problem is I just really don't know it's wrong. Well, that fell apart in the sixth step. Because I had done it in the fifth step, and I'd asked, you know, and I'd seen it, and I knew it was wrong, and I did it anyway. So now I had to come up with a reason for why it was wrong for you, and it's all right for me, you know. And therein lies the trouble with the sixth step, of course. So I think the sixth step is a process. It really does separate the men from the boys. It really is, do you want to start living your life based upon spiritual principles? Yeah. Or do you want to live your life based upon what you think you need and deserve? And, you know, I'm always reminded of my Thomistic background. Aquinas talked about the five ways. And what Aquinas said that we need to do, Thomas Aquinas said we need to do, what's most kind, most noble, and most loving. And so I had to stop doing what, as Bill Wilson would say, just enough to get me by. You know, Bill Wilson's sponsor was, after Ebbie, was the man he called a sponsor, was a Jesuit priest from St. Louis, Father Ed. And Ed was Thomist. And Ed would, and so Bill Wilson's writings, particularly in the 12 and 12, are riddled with ideas from Thomas Aquinas in the 12th century, 13th century. And, but I need to look not at what I need to do to get by, but what's the best way to do it? What's the most noble way to do it? What's the most loving way to do it? And that's what the sixth step is a process. Now, when I hear a guy's fifth step, I have him do the sixth and seventh step immediately. If I'm sponsoring him, okay, we live in the sixth and seventh step for a while. I have him read the sixth step one day in the 12 and 12, and the seventh step the next day in the 12 and 12. Like I say, I like the 12 and 12. My sponsor had me read the third step every day for 30 days. And I said, why should I do that? He said, well, if you do that, there'll be a miracle. I said, what's a miracle? He said, I'm not going to tell you. You have to do it. So I went back, and after 30 days, I said, I did it, Sandy. I read the 12 and 12, the third step, every day for 30 days. He said, well, he said, if you've done that, then there's a miracle. I said, what's a miracle? He said, well, if you've truly made a decision to turn your will and life over to the care of God, the miracle is your will and life is no longer in the hands of an idiot. That's the miracle. And and so the sixth and seventh step, I have him read the sixth step one day, the seventh step another next day. And what happens is, this desire we have to do it properly is always thwarted by some self-interest sense. Why it's okay for me to do and it's not okay for you to do, and that sort of thing. There's a tremendous sense of self-interest that enters into it. And I need to see that. And I come to conclude after a while that you're not the reason I'm the way I am. I'm the reason that I'm the way I am. It's not because I was raised in poverty. It's because I grew up. That's the problem. Because I was born, that's the problem. And I come to fully accept that my character defects weren't things that were inflicted upon me. Yeah. They were things that I developed myself out of selfishness and self-centeredness. Why don't we take a break? One of the things that it says at the beginning of the fifth step is that all 12 steps are contrary to our natures, okay? The way it says is that all of AA's 12 steps ask us to go contrary to our natural desires. They all deflate our egos, and that's what it's designed to do. There are trends around, and ideas, old ideas tend to recirculate, not only in my head, but they recirculate all around us. And one of the ideas I hear being talked about a lot now, and these things have ways of making it into Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the ideas is that what we have to do is develop a healthy ego. I really like that, a healthy ego. It's like I made a mistake one time of talking to my sponsor, and I said that awful word, false pride. And my sponsor said, oh, you're into true pride. And I, you know, every start like that, I knew it was going to go badly, you know. And I said, well, yes. I said, there's good pride. And he said, well, give me an instance. I said, well, he said, I'm proud to be sober. He said, well, you had a lot to do with that. He said, when you were in, he said, you were in charge, you were crapping your pants in public. I said, well, yeah. I said, so what I guess I am is I'm grateful to be sober. He said, yeah, that's probably it. And I said, well, you know, you can't give up with your sponsor. I mean, you can't lay down and, you know, they'll run all over you. So I said to him, well, I said, I'm proud of how my children are turning out. He said, well, that's something. He said, you weren't even allowed to see them. And they're turning out well. He said it probably has a lot to do with the fact that your wife's a good mother, or your ex-wife's a good mother. And I said, well, okay, I'm grateful they're turning out well. But you can't give up. I mean, you just can't. And the minute it was out of my mouth, I knew it was a mistake. I said, well, I'm proud to be an American. And he said, oh my God, he said, you had less to do with that than anything. He said, hadn't it been a potato famine, you wouldn't even be an American. So, I think what he says is true. So what I am is grateful. But this thought really is that what we need to do is that we have to get a healthy ego. Now, that may be fine for a non-alcoholic. I mean, they can play around with that stuff. You know, it's like a guy without the shakes can probably play with nitroglycerin. But if you've got the shakes, we wouldn't recommend it, okay? And this whole business, and Harry Thibault is a friend of the fellowship. And, you know, Bill Wilson often referred to Harry Thibault when he talked about our friends in psychiatry. And Harry Thibault wrote some things. And one of the things he wrote was something called The Ego Factors in the Surrender to Alcoholism. And it's a classic piece of work. If you are interested in this area, it's well worth reading. And in essence, what Dr. Thibault said was, if the alcoholic tries to get rid of all their ego, and the experts argue with us that if you get rid of all your ego, you can't exist. Okay? But Thibault says, if you try with the help of God to get rid of all your ego, you might get rid of enough of it to live. Okay? So it's not a problem for us ever having too little ego. Okay? That's probably not going to happen. You know, so don't worry too much about it. Okay? The other thing I like to talk about is how this process happens to us. I'm going to just step aside from the step just for a minute, just to talk about how this whole process of getting well works for us. You know, it's not a linear phenomenon. You ever have those days when you say to yourself, I haven't changed a bit. This isn't working for me, you know? And of course, that's not based on anything other than how we feel at the time. I used to call my ex-wife up to get her to affirm me, so we'd talk for a little while, and we'd always get into an argument because I'd ask her who she was seeing, and she'd ask me who I'm seeing, and whoever would ask if the other had a pain answer, that's none of your business. That hasn't been your business since you left me, or that hasn't been your business since you threw me out. And so she'd say, you haven't changed a bit. I hang up the phone. I go, oh no, you know. So I call my sponsor one time. I was talking to my ex-wife, and she said, I haven't changed a bit. And he said, let me make a suggestion to you. He said, if you want to know how you're doing, he said, call me. Don't call your ex-wife or her lawyer. He said, this is hard for you to believe, but they're not in this for you, Keith. Yeah. So this whole business about how we, you know, how we're doing or how we feel we're doing and everything, you know, my background in biology is helpful in this. If you take an amoeba or something and you put it on an auger plate, you know, amoebas grow on auger plates, and they begin to reproduce, they'll grow like crazy. It's called an S-curve. Okay? It's just like this. They grow like crazy. Okay, and then there's an amoeba for every square centimeter of auger. So they stop growing. And what they have to do is one has to die for another one to be born. You know? So they level off. Well, if you take and pour in a bunch of new media into a bigger plate, they take off again. And that's the way I think it is for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. Something will happen. Bill would say that pain is a touchstone of all growth, of all spiritual growth. Right? And I'll grow like crazy because a painful situation arises or I'm in it or something like that. And I, you know, I have to rely on God. I have to do the things that I need to do. And I do the steps or whatever's indicated. And I grow like crazy. And then I level off. And if I level off for a while, it feels like it felt down here. So I want to say I haven't changed a bit. I'm just saying, well, of course I've changed. I used to be there, and now I'm here. Now, after a while I get bored and pain comes along, and pain really is our friend. I mean, it really is our friend. My mother taught me that as she died of cancer, but pain is true. I always knew it theoretically, that pain is truly our friend. And I spent my whole life trying to avoid pain. I was an Epicurean. Epicurus was a philosopher who believed in what's called the principle of joy and happiness, and never wanted any pain. The whole object of life is to avoid pain. He's dead now. Been dead for thousands of years. But I don't believe that that's possible. Not if we're going to live in the real world. Not if we're going to be of service to God and to our fellows. And to avoid pain or to miss pain is to miss the best part. Bill Wilson was sober about 5 years when he met Father Dowling, and Father Dowling came to see him, and Bill was living over top of the clubhouse in New York City. And in a book, The Soul of Sponsorship, it talks about their meeting, and Bill was sober, I think it was 5 or 6 years, and I'm not positive, but I think it was that length of time when he met Father Dowling. And Dowling had read the Big Book and was just amazed at the 12 steps. It was just like the spiritual exercises of Ignatius Loyola, who was the founder of the Jesuits, and Father Ed was a Jesuit, and he loved it. He read the 12 steps, and they just made eminent practical sense to him. And so he went looking for Bill, and he found Bill, and Bill didn't want to talk to him and everything, but Dowling asked him some very obnoxious questions, like, have you done these 12 things? You know, I wrote those things. Yeah, you wrote them, but have you done them? And Bill talked to him about the pain, and he said, will it always hurt? Will it always be painful? And Dowling just exploded into a smile. He said, yes, that's the beauty of it. And I imagine that was not the best news Bill had that day, but what he meant was, there are some people who called on to always push, and Bill was one of those driven people that was given a lot to do and a lot to deal with and that sort of thing, and I think that's what made him the leader for us that he was. It wasn't that he got it all solved, it was that he was always working on it. And that's the thing to remember. I live my whole life like someday I'd be finished, and I'd be there. And I didn't know what there was. There might be a house on a golf course. It might be more money than I can spend in a lifetime and a half in case I live longer than I expect to live. I don't know what it there was. But I was always looking to the destination, and I never considered the journey. And the journey is where we meet God. You know, one of the things that... when I was studying theology, one of the things that I found as a person who always projected, again, I don't blame it on this, but well, when you're a kid and you grow up in poverty and you're in uncomfortable circumstances, as a family, what you don't talk about how it is. You always talk about how it's going to be. And you learn to dream, and my mother would read us poetry and would talk about things that are outside of where we are, and how it's going to be, or how it was, and we always grab a hold of these concepts that were different than now, and that's where I lived. And I lived in fiction. I lived, I had a secret place I'd go to, and all the things that someone who's having a very difficult time with now has. And I think to a large degree that's why I studied theology. Because I think it was W.C. Fields was dying in a room in Philadelphia, and so they caught in somebody. Somebody walked in on him. He's reading the Bible, and he tried to hide it. And they caught him. And they said, "Aha! Have you changed your mind about God?" And he said, "No, I was just looking for loopholes." And so I think that part of what was wrong with me was my inability to live in the now. I learned in theology that there are two kinds of time. Okay, there's something called chronos, which is chronological time. You know, right now it's about 20 minutes to 11. Okay? That's chronological. And, 5 minutes from now it'll be 15 minutes to 11. You can rely on it. It's chronological. Okay? There's another kind of time called kairos, which means God's time. And God's time is always right now. It's always right now. That's why if we spend a minute together, in God's time we spend forever together. I can only meet God now. I can't meet him in the future. I can't meet him in the past. I can read about him. I can study about him. I can study theology about him in the past. I can study what Hegel thought about him and how he, you know, how he's the God that cuts through time and that sort of thing. But I can't meet him any time but now. And that's what's so special about being at a place like this. You know, we can take that walk through the grotto and the gardens, or we can go over and visit Father Hilary, and as he used to say, the good monks, you know, the ones in the graveyard. And we can take that time and now experience the presence of God. But we can't say, you know, next week I'm going to go to Fatima, or I'm going to go to Lourdes, or I'm going to go to Akron, Ohio, or I'm going to go to the farm in New York and meet God. We have to do it now. And that's what's so important about our relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous and outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's always now. You know, before I got on the plane Friday morning, I always hold my wife for a little bit in the morning, and I always say a prayer for her, and she says a prayer for me. But I held her, and so I miss her, but I'm with her forever because I held her in God's time. And those are the kinds of concepts that the 12 steps teach us. And it's a different kind of a way of looking at life than the way I'd always been trained to look at life. Go to school, get an education. You get an education, you can do anything. And I thought that when you walked off the stage with a degree in your hand, your life was set. You know? And all you are is a well-educated, unskilled laborer. When you walk off, you know, you walk off the stage with a degree in your hand. I knew nothing about life or any of the rest of it. There was always those times when it would be okay. And what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is that it's got to be okay now. The other thing I wanted to mention, to finish with this. So my job is to enjoy the times when there's great spiritual growth, and then enjoy the times when there's great peace and level, and then enjoy the times when they again become painful in the next bit of growth that's supposed to take place, knowing that God will deliver it. I'd like to talk about God's will. I went to my sponsor one time, and I was just angry. I was in a job up to my eyeballs and everything. I was just angry, and I said to him, I said, I need to know what God's will is in my life. And he said, in the state of mind you're in now, God's will is not your will. And he said, I said, well, how do you know that? He said, well, he said, God's will isn't frantic, and it isn't driven, and it isn't forced. And that's what you are now, is you're frantic and you're driven and you're forced, so it can't be God's will. So God's will is not your will. And he said, instead of trying to figure out what God's will is, why don't you find out how you can let go of your will? What is it that you want? What is it that you feel needs to happen in order to make your life work? And then why don't you give that up? And I thought over the years of how many times the mistakes I'd made. I was sober about a year and a half, and the old timer was right. In about 2 years, that problem goes away, and I decided it was time for me to seek balance. And I didn't know how you go about seeking balance. And I'd had some pretty bad experiences seeking balance in my life, and I was sober a short period of time, I was telling my sponsor about this nurse who worked at the hospital and how cute she was and about her smile, and I'm going on, and he said, why don't you ask her out? I said, oh, I couldn't do that. And he said, why? I said, well, I just couldn't. And he said, well, I think it's time. He said, you know, you're legally separated and everything. And he said, you'll soon be divorced. He said, I think it's perfectly fine to take someone to the theater or to do something, go to a movie or to dinner. He said, why don't you ask her out? And I said, well, I don't know if I can do that. He said, look, I'm tired of hearing about it, so if you don't ask her out, I'm going to break your knee. Okay, I'll ask her out. So he said, you promise? No, I said, I promise. He said, the next time. I said, I promise. So 3 times later, right, I see her in a hospital. And it was right outside of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology. I don't know if that's important. Freud might think so, but I ran into her, and I said, hi, which I thought was clever. And now prior to this, you have to know, now this is a bad word, it wasn't a bad word then, but I stalked her. Now, you know what that means. You know, I don't mean that I followed her around. But what it meant was I'd look at her and see how she looked at me. And then I'd see how she looked at other guys, and on and on. Because you know, you really have to reduce your chances of being rejected. Because if you're rejected, it proves everything you've always known. And so you really have to, and so you'd hint around and do all this stuff, you know. And so finally I walked up to her, because I'm a new guy and I'm 30 years old. Think about it, I'm 30 years old. And I walked up to her and I said hi, and I said, "Are you busy Saturday night?" And I wasn't 30 years old, I was 15 again. And I said, "Oh, you probably are, and even if you weren't, you wouldn't want to go out with me anyway." And I turned around and walked away, you know. And I stopped and I said, "That didn't come out very well." She said, "No kidding." You know. And I said, "Would you like to go out Saturday night?" She said, "I'd love to. Don't say any more." I said, "All right." Yeah. It's funny. So, but anyway, another time I was seeking balance, and so I asked this girl, and I took her, and this is awful. There are two things in my big book, my original big book, and I'm just two things that I keep. I never want to forget either of these things, okay? The first one, I'd met a girl, and it was in October of 1975. It's all written there, and I found out that she wasn't one who had partaken of spirits in the past, so I took her to the China Doll in Chinatown in Washington, D.C., and convinced her that warm sake would be the thing that would set her free. And so I'm feeding her this warm sake, assuring her that it's perfectly fine. I can't drink it, you see, because I'm a recovering alcoholic, but it's okay for you to drink. So then the fortune cookies came, and my fortune said, "What sobriety conceals, drunkenness reveals." And I thought, "Oh my God." So I excused myself, and I went and I called my sponsor. And Dan said, "You're where? You're doing what?" He said, "You take that girl home and get your ass over here." So I said, you know, I'm taking her home. She's pulling up my clothes and everything. Oh, it was just awful. And I said, "I can't. My sponsors, I have to go see him. What are you, gay?" "No, no, I'm not. I'm all right." You know. And so I take her home and I go over and see my sponsor. Well, that's an example of self-will. That's when I'm not going to wait for God's will to evolve in my life. I'm going to make it happen. And the other one, and I'll talk a little bit about it later, because I like to, at these, I like to talk about what happens when the tough times come. You know, and tough times come in sobriety. I mean, when we get sober, we live life. And life happens to us. And it isn't what happens. It's how we deal and how we use what happens. That's what sobriety is. That's the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous, is it teaches me how to live with the very difficult things that happen to everybody. Not just live with them, but to grow through them and to be an example and helpful to others and all that. Because ultimately, everything we do, the value of it isn't even that it's over. The value is that we've done it and we can help others. Okay? But I had made out a list one time. I don't know, some guy who runs around, screams and hollers and tells you how to live your life, and you do these things, see, and you visualize and you do all this stuff. And I was supposed to make a list of all the things I wanted to do with my life. And one of them was to work internationally. Now, I think about it now, it makes no sense. I don't even like getting on airplanes, you know, but I'm going to work internationally, you know. I mean, I didn't have all the pieces in place, but, you know, maybe I wanted to take a ship, I don't know, but but at any rate, I had work internationally. Well, what became what was called goals became have-tos. And if this doesn't happen, somehow I failed. Well, I heard about this job was opening up in England. It would take place in Ireland. It must be God's will, because my ancestors are from England and Ireland. So, you know, I mean, makes perfect sense to me. Anybody with a half a grain of spiritual insight at all would recognize that one right away. Now, the fact that there are about 80 million people in this country who had relatives in Ireland and England, and only one job, never crossed my mind, you know. But so I put my resume together, and I mean, it was mostly true, you know. I mean, there are a few exaggerations in there, but I mean, if I don't think well of myself, who's going to think well of me, you know? And so I put this lying resume together, and I took it to him, and I went over to the Watergate where he was staying to interview. An interview with the job and everything, and by the grace of God, I never got that job, because shortly after that, I went through an experience I'll share with you later, But had I been in England, I think I'd have died. Or had I been in Ireland, I would have died. And what's important about that is that's the only job I've ever asked for in Alcoholics Anonymous. Every other thing I've ever done, I've done because somebody asked me to do it. That's waiting on God's will. And when I make it happen... Now, between jobs, I did the things you need to do. I talked to people. I made inquiries. I did this, I did that. But I've never done what I was headed toward. You know, I need to be heading toward it because I need to occupy myself and I need to put myself in that frame of mind. You know, I need to make getting a job a job. But I never got a job I went for. While I was in the process of doing that, God always sent something else. And I don't know how to explain that to you other than the fact that for 26 years it's been true. Now, each time one thing ends, I have the same sort of anxiety. You know, I know he's going to forget about me. I'm going to go to the poorhouse or the wayside. I'm not sure which, but one of them. And all that's still there, but immediately I can stop it. But I think it's critical to know. And so they sent me a telegram telling me that the problem, that they found my resume very interesting. So did I. I just went back from time to time to read it again. They liked my experience and things, but that I was too young. And I keep that in my big book. If you ever come to my house, and you're welcome anytime, ask them to see my big book, and you'll see that telegram, that job, and the fortune cookie taped on the front page from the China Doll in 1975 when I was seeking balance using sake. These are just examples of what happens when I take over. And the great danger for me is feeling good. You know, when I feel good, I take over. I mean, I always did, didn't I? I mean, you know, like after the third drink, I wanted to make the drinks because I was feeling good. And the same thing is true at life. When I start feeling good, I want to lay out the plan. You know, my mind starts to work, and I think all these wonderful things that I really need to do. There was a man whose story's in a big book, and he called me up one time, asked me to talk to him. I went down to see him, nice man. And he told me that he was leaving this position, he wanted me to take it. I said, well, you know, I'm doing something else now. And he said, you're the only other person who could do this. I'm thinking, this is scary. One or both of us is off the edge here. But what he was going to do was go right. So he's always wanted to go right, and he's going to go to the keys to right. Well, I've always wanted to go to the keys to right, too. I said, you're really lucky. I said, my sponsor always tells me that he's pretty sure, he doesn't know what God's will is for me, but he's pretty sure running off by myself to the keys to right isn't one of them. And he said, I don't listen to that stuff anymore. He said, I've been sober a long time. I don't need to go running someplace to get permission. Boy, the flags just went up. Well, you know what happened. I mean, you know, within 6 months, I 12-stepped this man in a psychiatric hospital and then in a jail and on and on. It's because he developed what my friend Hal M. calls alcoholism. You know, he was no longer an alcoholic. He'd had a bad habit, and that's gone now. And I always want to keep that in mind when I think that I'm moving on. You know, what I have is alcoholism, not alcoholism. I've had bad habits, believe it or not. I have had a few. One of them, for example, was cigarettes. Now, I have nothing against cigarettes, but for me, it was a bad habit. And 23 years ago, last month, by the grace of God, I had my last cigarette up until today. That's a habit. That's not a disease. Alcoholism is a disease. I won't be walking through life one day and find myself smoking a cigarette wondering how it happened. I don't go to meetings 4, 5, 6 days a week to keep from smoking. I don't sit down and share with another God, myself, and another human being the exact nature of my wrong and talk about my behavior smoking. Yeah, you know, I smoked when? Oh, my goodness, you did? Yeah, I smoked and I went to jail. Oh, my goodness. No. No, that's a bad habit. Alcoholism is a disease. I'm no longer addicted to nicotine. I'm still as much an alcoholic today as I was May the 13th, 1973, when I took my last drink. And I'm further along the trail of progression than I was. If I picked up a drink now, it would be as though I drank these 26 and a half years. Okay? If I picked up a cigarette now, it's not like that. It's not like that. So I never confuse myself. And if the reason I think this is important, because there are certain phases in our recovery when we drift away. We drift away. 18 months is a very dangerous time for me. I was sober 18 months, and I had become a responsible employee again. The university was glad to have me, and I was going to prove they were right. And I was going to make up for all those things that I had done. Amends is one thing. You know, living in guilt is something else entirely. And I was going to make up for all the things I had done wrong. So I began this process of working like a lunatic. And I'm going to school and I'm studying. And when I'm not studying, I'm working. And for the first and only time in the 26 plus years that I've been sober in Alcoholics Anonymous did I drift away from AA. And I didn't mean to. Let me tell you how it happened. Every morning I was going to go to a meeting that evening. And every evening I found a reason for that day why I wouldn't go to that meeting. And the days turned into a week. And then the week turned into 2 weeks. And I was at the hospital Sunday evening. And I was working. I was catching up on some of my work and doing some photography, microphotography and things. And I looked at the clock, and my home group met at 8:30 on Sunday night. And I said, it's 7:30. I said, I'll leave at 8 and get there in plenty of time. Well, 8 came, and I'll just do this. And then I'll do this. And I looked, and it was 8:30, and I said, oh, I missed it again. Well, I'll go tomorrow. And I finished up at about 8:45, and I got in my car to drive home, because it's too late now. And a gas main had blown up, and so they rerouted the traffic, and I had to go right by this church where my home group met. Well, there's never a parking space in front of the church, but there was a parking space right in front of the church. I said, oh, what the hell? So I stopped, sort of upset that this twist of fate had done this to me. And I went into the church, and it's 9:15. Right? The meeting goes from 8:30 to 9:30. There are two speakers, the second speaker speaking. It's 9:15. 9:30 comes. I'm looking at my watch saying, doesn't she know that the meeting's only supposed to last an hour? I've only been there 15 minutes. And she said, I sat down next to a guy who stopped drinking a day after me. And he was doing the same sort of thing, a little bit different. He wasn't wrapped up in work. He had fallen in love, which happens. And he had fallen in love with a girl who wasn't in AA, because after all, he says, I don't need to confuse my life by dating someone in AA. So he dated someone who wasn't in AA, and he was buying her beer and watching her drink it. I mean, perfectly normal way to live your life. And he also had, somebody brought him to that meeting, or he wouldn't have been there. And we're sitting side by side in the front row. Is the only seat left in the front row. And all those judgmental people watch me come in late and go up there. And then she talked about when she was celebrating 3 years that night, and she was talking about when she was sober a year and a half, how she drifted away from Alcoholics Anonymous, how other things became more important, and how she drank. And boy, he and I both saw that bolt right. And after the meeting, we took her for coffee, and we kept her up till midnight talking. And by the grace of God, that's the only time that I've ever been away from Alcoholics Anonymous for any appreciable length of time without meetings. And it was probably 2 weeks. And to me, it was an eternity. And the reason it was an eternity, because it took me to the point where I would have stepped off the abyss. The bulk of the 12-step work I do, and I don't understand people who don't have 12-step calls. I have as many as I want. I set them up. I make sure that I get 12-step work. The bulk of the men I talk to on 12-step calls are men who retired from someplace else, moved to Wilmington, which is a lovely place to live, mean to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and never quite get around to it. Well, I mean, you have to get the house right, and then you have to join the club, and then you have to practice your putting, and then we have to figure out which church we're going to go to. But I'm going to go to AA, I really am. And then one day it's 6 months or 3 months or 6 months or a year later, and there's no AA. And then there's that drink, the inevitable drink that comes, because we have a disease, progressive and fatal. And always have it. So I really like to keep all that in mind. I believe meetings are important. The regularity of meetings are important. You know, now meetings aren't the program. And I don't go to meetings to feel better. I invariably do feel better. But I don't go there to feel better. I go to meetings because that's part of the program. I'm expected to be there. I'm expected to show up. And that's where I learn what I need to learn. We could talk about one other thing, too, because I know that a constant companion of mine during my alcoholism is this thing called guilt. I don't know if anybody here knows anything about guilt, you know. My friend Mike W. says it well. I went to him one time, and I'd known Mike since I was sober about 8 months, 8 or 9 months, and I met Mike. And he has truly been my best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous from then until now. I've had some great friends, three or four real, real close friends. But I said to Mike one time, I said, Mike, can you tell me anything about guilt? And Mike started laughing. He said, of course I can tell you about guilt. He said, when I was 3 years old, he said, my mother set me on her knee and she read this book to me. And at the end of the book, they asked the question, who killed Cock Robin? And Mike said, I thought, I don't know, but I probably did. Okay, so that's the kind of guilt that we're talking about. I've heard it described as primordial guilt. It's sort of like guilt that I come with, you know. I come with my own load of guilt. And of course it comes from self-centeredness. And, you know, it says that I am responsible for things that I can't be responsible for. I felt guilty about the war in the Middle East. I just felt terrible about that. I've never been in the Middle East, you know. I had nothing to do with that war, but I felt guilty about it. I feel guilty if I eat and somebody else doesn't. On and on. I don't see any of that as God's hand in any of it. I mean, I just assume all this stuff, which is insane, of course. You know, and I was sober a few months and went to my home group was Thursday night, like I say, Sunday night. And at Thursday night, we had a step study meeting. And then on Sunday night, there was a speaker meeting. And this Thursday night, there was a man came to lead second step for us. And his name was Happy Harold. And he was a black man, a wonderful man. And I couldn't hear anything he said. I don't know if you've ever had times like this, but I would go places and I was so into myself. I was so self-absorbed that people's mouths were moving, but I wasn't registering anything they were saying. And I was just into myself. And I'm thinking about the kids and I can't see the kids and I'm going on and on and I've ruined the kids and I've damaged them forever. And God, who knows, one of them might even end up going to Auburn or something. I mean, just, you know. You know, I just couldn't let myself off the hook, and so I was. We used to go on Thursdays. We would go to this place. It's like a Christian bookstore, but they served homemade cake and pie and ice cream. It's just delicious, and coffee. So we'd go there and get, you know, sort of herb teas or coffee or something like that, and talk. And Harold was there, and he's at another table, and I couldn't hear anything. And I just decided I was just going to go home. And I didn't know what was going to happen to me, but I mean, I was not in a good state of mind. That's for sure. And I was leaving the place, and Harold said to me, he said, I don't know you. He said, you got a few minutes? I'm thinking, well, if I'm going to go and die, you know, there's no rush. So I sat down, and he said, you don't look very happy. I said, well, I said, I feel really bad. And he said, why? And I said, well, I feel guilty. And I talked about the kids and how I couldn't see them and on and how guilty I felt. And he said, I know, and he didn't talk to me about my kids. But what he said to me was, I know all about guilt. And he told me this story. He said, when my mama was dying, she called me from the intensive care unit and said, son, will you be here tomorrow morning? I want to see my children before I go home. And she said, but don't come drinking. She said, Harold, if you're drinking, don't come. And he said, the next day I showed up to the hospital and I was drunk. And I said, you were? He said, of course I was. He said, I was an alcoholic. And he said, I didn't know how not to be drunk then. And he said, my brothers and sisters said, you know, you can't go up and see Mama like that. So he called up to talk to his mother, and he said, Mama, can I come and see you? And she said, you drinking, son? And he said, yes, I am. And she said, I can't go into eternity seeing my oldest boy drunk. And he said, so while my brothers and sisters said goodbye to my mama, he said, I sat down in the waiting room alone. And he said, she died that day. And I said, how do you live with that? How do you live with that? And he smiled the way Harold always smiles, and he said, you'll discover if you stay with us that the worst you do becomes your greatest gift. And I thought, wow, you know, I was just overwhelmed. I forgot about myself for a little while, went home, actually had a decent night's sleep. And it must have been a few months later, I was in the hospital, and it was Harold. And I saw him by the elevator, and we laughed and shook hands and talked and this sort of thing. And he left, and I was walking away, and a nurse stopped me, and she said, do you know Mr. B? And I said, you mean Happy Harold? She said, you know, he's the finest man we know. And I said, really? She said, you know, she said, whenever we have an old person here who's alone and doesn't have anybody and they're dying, we call Harold. And I remembered what he said, the worst you do becomes your greatest gift. And so that's why if you're kind of new and you've done things that you think you can never be forgiven for, please take heart. Because one day, as a result of these steps, they become your great gifts. You know, no one needs us in Alcoholics Anonymous because we've made $1 million or because we've been successful in life. That's not why they need us. That's not our value. My value in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I broke everything I touched and my life was given back to me. And that's the hope that I carry. The hope I carry is that I've broken everything I've touched and my life has been given back to me and I lead a happy life today. That's the message, isn't it? That's the message. It's not what I've done right. It's what I've done wrong and it's what God's fixed. And not just fixed, He fixed as a result of what I had broken. And that's the value of it. So I always want to remember that. And I think it's worth reminding one another that the great strength and the great power we have in our life isn't what we've done right, what we've done wrong. It's the stuff that's not on the resume. Yeah. Even the true stuff that belongs on the resume. That's not why we're of value. And I never confuse that. I'm not here because I've done things well. I'm here because I broke everything I touched in the grace of God for whatever reason chose me to be so. Whatever reason. Chose me to live. I was pretty newly sober and I was wallowing in self-pity and I was just angry. Now, I'd like to say something about that too. You know, my anger is a form of anger that came out in profanity. I don't know if anybody can relate to that. But it seemed as though it had to be profane, and it came out of my mouth. And I did it in meetings, so I'm not proud of it. It's just reality. And I was telling Maggie yesterday that I met a woman, a very elegant woman, very regal in her carriage and all, and she said to me, she said, after a meeting, she said, "Young man, may I ask you a personal question?" I said, "But of course." And she said, "Do you eat with the same mouth you talk with?" And I said, "It's pretty offensive, huh?" She said, "It's terribly offensive." And she said, "I have a feeling you don't need to do that. You probably have an adequate vocabulary." And from that day till this, I pray that I haven't said anything that's offensive to other people. But that's the form that my anger and my rage took. It just came out. And we were doing a bone marrow on a young woman one time, and I never want to forget this. I was sober maybe 2 months, not long at all. She was a beautiful woman. She had red hair. She was just beautiful. And she was crying. It was a very painful, cut down to a very painful procedure. And they were taking bone marrow out of her collarbone, sternum, I guess it's called, whatever it's called there. And I was there just to take the sample and to grow it and to do karyotyping and genetic testing and things. And she was crying and she was looking at me. I was standing there so that she saw me. And she said, "You know, it's not fair," she said, "that I have this illness." And I'm thinking, you know, it's not fair that I have this illness. And she said, "You know, my husband couldn't handle this. He took the children and left." And I'm thinking, you know, my wife couldn't handle me and she took the children and left. And then she said the key to me. She was crying. She said, "I'll do anything if I can be well." And she had leukemia and I spent time with her the next 30 days and she died. And 30 days later, I was sober 3 months. And you had to wonder about that. I had to wonder about God's value system. Because I surely would have picked her over me. And the only thing I can conclude is that God must have things for us to do. Has things for us to do. My brother Terry died of this disease. And I'll tell you about that in my ninth step. Terry's much nicer than me. Terry's the kind of guy who would collect aluminum cans. He was living on the street. He would collect aluminum cans and he'd take half the money and give it to somebody who needed it. You know? I mean, he could do things drunk. I couldn't do so. And I guess God let him do what he needed to do drunk. And he needed me to be sober to do what it is he wanted me to do. That's the power of this program. And I'd like to talk about these things simply because this isn't all mechanical. You know, the steps certainly are actions that we take. But sobriety is an experience. The book says it's an experience. We don't want to miss it. We don't want to miss. Now, we don't see it well in ourselves, but boy, we can sure see it well in other people. And we really don't want to miss that. You know, I did a 12-step call about 2 weeks ago on a young man. He was 24 years old, and he got a less than honorable discharge from the Army, and he was about $14,000 in debt, and his life was over. And I picked him up, and I took him off to, I have a bookstore I like to go to and get coffee, Barnes and Noble's, and get a cup of coffee and sit down and talk. And then I took him to the meeting, and then after the meeting we went back and had another cup of coffee and talked. And I took him home, and I was sitting outside his house, his parents' house, and he said, you know, he said, my life is just too screwed up. This won't work for me. And I said to him, I said, well, you know, it's your choice, certainly. I said, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is there, and I'll be available to you. You call me, I'll come and get you. Do whatever we want to do. He said, but I'm hopelessly in debt. And I said, you know, I was $14,000 in debt 27 years ago. And I said, in 2 years I was. And he said, yeah, but he said, I've got a less than honorable discharge from the Army. I said, you know, 3 years from now you can reapply and I'll change it. And I said, you know, you're very fortunate. I said, I know you don't feel that way, but you're very fortunate. You've broken very little in your life. And he couldn't see it. He was too far gone. The next day, I went to a prison to visit a guy that I sponsored. He's got 2 years now. He's been in prison for 30 years. And we're working on his eight-step list. And as we'll talk about later when we get to the eighth step, the getting ready in the eighth step is forgiving. Forgiving. You know, the great secret to grace and happiness and peace of mind is forgiveness. And I was talking to him about forgiveness, and he'd forgiven someone who'd done him a great wrong. And he began to cry. And he said to me, it's amazing to me that I've been given this, and I've suffered so little to get it. Here's a man who's been in prison longer than this man I talked to the night before had been alive. And he had seen that his 30 years in prison and everything else was a small price to pay for what he had. And I always think of one of my favorite scriptures about the jewel of great price. And that's what sobriety is. Sobriety is a jewel of great price. And before you buy it, the price is too great. After you acquire it, there's no price too great. And the difference has nothing to do with anything except the grace of God. It's the possession of the great gift that makes the price meaningless. And so that's why this whole process of recovery, this sobriety, these steps, looking at it from the alcoholism end, it looks impossible for a couple days. And I'm sure that to this wonderful woman, this looks impossible. We have people here who are sober 37 years or whatever. And from that perspective, you'd ask, who wouldn't pay for this? Who wouldn't buy this? We pay so little to get here once we've been here. And I think it's one of the great, great mysteries, the great spiritual mysteries. You know, it's not unlike the martyrs and the saints and on, who lived very, very difficult lives, overcame tremendous things. And they always felt guilty because what they had been given was so freely given. But I bet if you set any one of them down and said to them, look, you can be a saint one day, but this is what you have to do. They'd say, got any other jobs? I know they would, you know. Because from that end, it looks impossible. From the other end, we wonder why we waited so long. Why did I wait so long to do that third step? You know, why did I wait so long to do a spiritual inventory? You know, why did I wait so long to share this with God and myself and another human being? Why did I wait so long to become entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character? You know, once they're gone, we'll say, why do you want that anyway? All that ever did was cause me grief. I don't know why I hung on to it for so long. The sixth and seventh step, of course, is the process, and it's the process we're talking about now. And I want to talk a little bit more about it when we get together this afternoon. But let me say this about it. And if you read the transcript of the original Big Book, if you don't, I would urge you to get a copy of the transcript, the original transcript of the Big Book. It's interesting. Anybody here read it? Have you read it? It's a fascinating thing. And the story I'm told about it is that Bill took it to a psychiatrist friend. I don't know who it was. I don't know if it was Harry Thiebaud or who it was. But it was written a way I hear people talking, some people talking to alcoholics, you know, you will do, you know, with the, everything but the finger wagging, you know. And that's the way it was written. And so they took it, and the psychiatrist looked at it and said, well, this is interesting, but this isn't what you guys do. So what do you mean? It's what we do. No, no, no. You don't tell people what they need to do. You tell them what you did. You share with them what you did. And why is that important? I think it's important because when we talk about what we did, we recognize how easy it was to do. When we tell someone what they must do, we're giving them impossible tasks. Impossible tasks. You know, I was going to talk about this in the 12th step, but I had a wonderful example of this not too long ago. One of the things I like to do is, we have a teaching hospital in our hometown, and I like to go to the person who puts a curricula together for the teaching hospital, and I always say to them, you know, I'm a long-time member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not an old-timer, but I'm a long-time member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, if your interns, if you want, I'd be glad to talk to your interns about Alcoholics Anonymous and what we do. And they're always glad for people to do things like that. So I'll talk to a group of incoming interns, and these are all bright kids and ready to go, you know, and I talk to them about Alcoholics Anonymous and tell them I have cards, not business cards, but personal cards with my name and phone number, and if you ever have anybody who might want to talk to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I said, I'll be glad to talk to them. I said, if it's a woman, I said, I know plenty of women who are marvelous members of Alcoholics Anonymous, they'll come and talk to them. Okay. Well, I get a call one day from a young girl, and she said, I hate to bother you, this is Dr. So-and-so, and you spoke to our group about Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, we have a man that, he's totally non-communicative. And the only rise that we've gotten out of him at all is we asked him if he'd be willing to speak to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he nodded his head. And she said, you probably don't want to bother, because he isn't willing to listen. And I said, I'll be right there. Well, you know, I like to put on a tie in situations like that, or at least get dressed up. And so I put on a tie and I went over there, and the young girl met me, and she said, I brought his chart. Would you like to have a look at his chart? I says, no, I know what's in his chart. And so she took me to his room, and there was a guy laying in bed looking at the ceiling, just laying there, had his robe and pajamas on, just laying there looking at the ceiling, and had those paper slippers on. Why he had those on, I don't know, but he hadn't gone anywhere, but probably getting ready. But she began to lecture him. She said, now, John, this man has come here. He's taken time out of his day to come here to talk to you. And I said to her, I said, thank you very much. So then she starts to pull up a chair, and I said, could you excuse us, please? She looked a little bit shocked, you know, and so she left. And she closed the door almost. She kept it slightly ajar. And she was lurking out there. You know how people lurk, you know? My wife lurks. She's a lurker. If I'm sick, you know, I'll go to the guest room or something if I'm sick and I don't want to infect her. And she lurks outside. I hear her lurking, and she just loves me, so, you know, she lurks outside the door. Well, this doctor was lurking out there, and so I did what we do, you know. I mean, it isn't about this guy talking. He's not doing a 12-step call. I'm doing a 12-step call. So I just sit down, and I began to share my experience with, you know, my drinking. And I was talking about my drinking. I talked about the progression, like the book says. It's very simple, you know. And then I talked about Harvard Street, and this man looked at me and he said, Harvard Street in Washington? And I said, yeah. And he said, I lived on Columbia Road. I said, no. He said, when were you there? And I said, well, I said 1973. He said, me too. And I said, where'd you buy your booze? Did you go to Columbia, Ontario Liquor Store? He said, yeah, on Columbia Road. I said, yeah. And I said, remember the big barrel they had? He said, yeah, 3/5 for $10. I said, yeah, the good stuff. Yeah, we're really talking, you know, and pretty soon he's sitting up on the side of the bed, and we're talking and stuff, and we were laughing and everything, and uh, And so we talked for a little bit longer, and I said, would you mind if I came back tomorrow? He said, oh, I wish you'd come. I said, look, I got a couple of friends I know would like to meet you. They get along well with you. Would you mind if I bring them? Oh, I'd love it if you'd bring them. Thank you, sir, for coming, and on. And why leave? And this girl is just beside herself. She can't believe it. She said, that's the most magnificent thing I've ever seen. And she'd gone and gotten a few of the other interns, and they're all sort of gathered together, and she's filling them in. And you know, I love it. They wear stethoscopes around their necks so that you'll know they're doctors and not high school students, you know. And she said, would you be willing to do a workshop for us on how you do that? And I said, I'd be glad to. I said, are you willing to do some homework? She said, oh, yeah. I said, you have to drink real bad for at least 10 years, you know. And I went on to explain it, that this gift we have isn't about what we learn. It's about what we've done. I mean, I said to her, I said, I'm sure you're a wonderful doctor. And I said, if you don't mind a suggestion, I said, wherever you go to practice medicine, I said, meet a couple men and a couple women who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous and get their numbers. I said, I can't do much of anything, but I can do this. I said, God has given me this special gift just because of where I've been. Not because of who I am, but because of where I've been. My great value in the eyes of God is, one, I'm his son, but also the fact that I've been where I've been. Not because he wanted me to be there. I went in spite of him. But since he's been there and he brought me back, I have things to say. And I have a message to carry. One of my favorite stories in the Bible is the prodigal son and how he came back. I can't read that without weeping. And I often wonder what it must have been like after that. You know, I imagine he went and made amends to his brother. You know, he said, you know, you were here and you were responsible and you hung out with Dad and you stuck with him and I was out goofing off and blowing the fortune and everything. Can I do anything to make that right? And I know his brother, because of the example of his father, would have to forgive him. You know. Then he'd say something like my brother said to me, God, we're proud of you. We're so proud of you. But then I wonder what he did the rest of his life. I think the value was he'd been there. Can't you imagine it? Maybe somebody lived in an ex-farm, said, I'm going to take half my fortune and I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And he said, let me share my experience and strength with you. You know, now you may have to do that, but maybe you won't have to do that. That's the beauty of that. You know, for years I loved the fact that he was taken back because I needed to be taken back. And I loved the fact that he was forgiven in it. They killed a fatted calf and they put a ring on his finger because I'm into stuff, you know. And I love the fact that he talked to Dumb Denny, put him down, you know. You know, Dad talked to Dumb Denny and said, look, your brother who was lost has been found, stop whining. But that isn't where it ends. I think where it ends is what he did with that great gift, the great gift of being brought back. And that's why I think it's critically important that we understand what it is and what we're about. And that what we're about is much bigger than us. It's much bigger than coming home and sitting with the woman you love in front of the fireplace and talking about the weekend. It's about spending, if you have to, even spend a night in Atlanta with a bunch of Democrats. I mean, you know, whatever it takes, you know, whatever it takes to make the phone call, to be of service. That's the stuff that's important, I think. And the reason I like to talk about this is, frankly, retreats about the 12 steps concern me because it's often seen as something I go away and learn or something I go away and do. And that's not what it is. It's something I live on a daily basis. Our sponsors ought to be teaching us about the 12 steps in the book. And I know many of our sponsors did. That's where it needs to be learned. I think it's nice to discuss these principles in places like retreats. And I think retreats are good for just that, to retreat and reassess and reevaluate. But I think that the beauty of the 12 steps is that a man who grew to love me and who I grew to trust, maybe the first person I trusted in a long time, took me by the hand and walked me through these things and lived it with me day in and day out. That's the value and the beauty of this. You know, I have a close friend who asked me to always remember something.
and that is the fifth tradition. It says each group has but one primary purpose, and that's to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. That's what it's for me. It's not to be happily married, though I am. It's not to be a father whose children has largely forgiven him, so they have. You know, it's not to be a son that my parents are proud of, though they are. It's to carry the message to the still suffering alcoholic. That's my primary purpose, and that's the purpose of my home group. When we do our group inventory, the question we ask ourselves is, what are we doing for the newcomer? We give great parties. We have great fellowship. But when you are a newcomer and you walk into our group, do you feel welcome? You know, do you feel like this is a place that you might be accepted and cared about? It's to carry the message to the newcomer. Carry the message to the person who still suffers. May or may not be a newcomer, huh? I've done a lot of suffering late in life. But that's the value of all of this. And I like to say that just basically as a cautionary note. I do a fair number of 12-step retreats and things, and I love them. But don't, you know, the 12 steps is a way of life. It's the way we live. It isn't what we go away and do. My favorite retreats are silent retreats, for obvious reasons. I don't have to talk. But they really are. When I retreat, I like to go away to a silent retreat. And I'd recommended that to a friend here, that you go. And I'll tell you why it's important is, I spend my whole life getting ready to react to you. Just like I spent my whole life getting ready to react to life. I was like the pinball in the pinball machine. Whichever bumper I hit, that's the direction in which I went, you know. And that's what life tended to always do to me. And I'd hit a bumper and I'd head this way and I'd start preparing myself for the next thing I was going to run into. Well, silent retreat's nice because I go there and as a Friday evening, you don't talk. And somewhere during Saturday, it occurs to me that I don't have to prepare myself for the next encounter. I don't have to get myself ready to meet somebody or to talk to somebody. I can just be. And a great silence settles over you, and it's a wonderful thing, and I'd urge you to do that. And again, I don't want to rain on this in any way, shape, or form. It's an honor for me to be here. I think it's critically important that we understand that this isn't how we do the steps. This is how we get ideas, and we talk about them, and we share experiences. But the way we do the steps is with our sponsors. Okay? I think it's time for lunch, isn't it? Time for Mass. Okay, thank you very much. Okay. I'd like to spend a little bit more time on steps 6 and 7. I think that 6 and 7 are basically viewed as unimportant steps by a lot of people because it seems abstract, certainly, but it also seems less traumatic in a way than 4 and 5 and 8 and 9 and, you know, some of those things where we could be embarrassed. I mean, you know, you could downright be embarrassed about these things. And 6 and 7 appears to be sort of a throwaway. And there are a couple of things I'd like to say about 7. The beauty of 7, as Happy Harold would say, is that the worst becomes our greatest gift. And if you look at the prayer, the seven-step prayer in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, take all of us, the good and the bad, and use us. And yet, I was a guy who spent his whole life thinking I was supposed to prepare to do something. I was supposed to be perfect. And if I wasn't perfect, or if I didn't do it perfectly, I couldn't do it at all. And what I've come to realize is that the majority of my effectiveness is the way I bungle through life. And people look at me and say, and if he can get through life, anybody can get through life. And that's what I think the seventh step tells us, that what we admire in people is their trying. You know, what we admire in people. You imagine, I talk to alcoholics all the time, including alcoholics here, right? And I run into a group of people who maybe 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago thought of nothing but themselves and now are concerned because they don't think they're quite as good as God would like them to be. I think that's a significant change in a human being's life. I really do. And it shows that this program works. The sixth step is, again, just a continuing effort to change myself. in the failure of doing it. I'm going to make myself different. I'm not going to lie. You know, now that I know I don't need to lie, now that I know that lying isn't good for me, I'm not going to lie anymore. 10 minutes later, I'm lying. And my head is saying to my mouth, you don't need to, you don't do this. And my mouth saying, you shut up, you stay out of this, you know. I may need to remember how to do this later on, you just never know. And that's it. And a friend of mine said to me one time that the sixth and seventh step are the most frustrating thing that he ever did. I said, well, if you're demanding perfection, I imagine that's so. But if you look at a guy who used to live his life based purely on self-will, and now you're struggling and really caring about being changed, being made better, you really care about character building, I think that in itself says a lot. I think that says a lot. And I'll tell you why I think it's critical. I think it's critical because of step 8. Step 7, it says, we had lacked the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first, and that material satisfactions were not the purpose of living. And I didn't know that. I always knew that security for me would never be poor like I was when I was a kid. Security to me would never be embarrassed or ashamed about the way I was dressed or about the way my parents were dressed. And I knew that if I had that, you know, a pair of Gucci shoes and some, you know, the right kind of clothes and that sort of thing, I knew if I had that, I'd be secure. I remember when I go to the theater and I put on my After 6 to go to the theater, I knew I was going to be secure, you know, because I had material things. And, you know, I mean, after all, if you're wearing a tuxedo and you're going to the theater, you're headed in the right direction. A year later, I was living on 14th and Harvard Street, but I mean, yeah, what the heck. Nearly all A's have found, too, that unless they develop much more of this precious quality, humility, than may be required just for sobriety, they still haven't much of a chance of becoming truly happy. So happiness doesn't require that I have a lot of material things. Happiness is happiness happens as a result of living a life based on humility. Seldom do we look at character building as something desirable in itself, something we would like to strive for whether our instinctual needs were met or not. We never thought of making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God the daily basis of living. I was talking to a friend of mine just not long ago, and I was telling her about my prayer every morning. And part of my prayer every morning is that I ask God to let me love my wife more than she loves me. And every night I feel like I fail. I remember and I think this is important because of my past, but I remember I was doing some work and I was in Wilmington. We were then living in Fayetteville, and I was doing some work, and I had called her. I'd gone to dinner with a group of friends, and I called her just to tell her how things were going. I'd see her, and she said, I'll see you this evening. And then we went on to dinner, and I got back to this place I was working. I was doing some workshops for them, and it was about 7 in the evening or something like that. And I got this, the secretary came in and said, there's an emergency call. And I called my wife back, and she was crying, and her mother had passed away. And I said, I'll be right there. I said, it takes 2 hours, and I'll be there. And I called a guy I sponsor, David, and he and his wife went over and sat with her. They took chicken. If someone dies in the South, fried chicken appears. It just happens that way. But they went over. They got chicken and went over. And if you see someone carrying fried chicken into someone's house, you know someone's passed. But I drove up there. I just dropped everything, of course. And I drove up there. And on the way up, I was thinking about how it had been some years earlier. You know, I got home one night at midnight, and of course I was drunk. And the woman I was married to then was sitting on the floor. And the floor around her was wet from tears, because her father had died, and she found out about it at 4:30, and she waited from 4:30 till midnight for her husband to come home. And I'm sober now, and I ask by the grace of God I never be a husband like that again. And so I was there, and
And that night I held her all night as she cried. And the next day we got up early and we went over to where her parents lived. And we began making all the arrangements. And her dad was sort of wandering around. And so she kind of took over and made all the arrangements. And I was with her every step of the way. And so I'm thinking, this is one day I'm going to show her I love her more than she loves me. And, you know, I've been looking for this for a long time. And that night I was holding her in bed and I kissed her goodnight. We said our prayers together. I kissed her goodnight. And she rolled over to go to sleep, and then she rolled back over. And she put her arms around me. And she said, "Forgive my selfishness." She said, "I'm thinking of myself, and I forgot how much you love Mother, too." And I thought, damn. I missed again. But that's the basis of life. That's why you want to live life on a spiritual basis. The way I grew up, and this isn't what I was taught, but this is the way I grew up, okay? The way I grew up was you played one-upsmanship. And you had to watch out for yourself. And, you know, you wouldn't bother worrying about what somebody else was feeling because, you know, you got to get yours. And, you know, and all the spiritual principles involved were they'll take advantage of you if they can. So your job is to not let them use you, and on and on and on. And I mean, I've made up most of this stuff, but that's the way I live my life. That's the way I live my life. Don't trust them. Be jealous. All those crazy, crazy rules for living. And now I don't have to do that, because what I do now is I do precisely what this book says. It says that we never thought of making honesty, tolerance, and true love of man and God our daily basis for living. I love the question they ask in this book. What would the Master do? If I can ask that question, what would the Master do? If I can ask that question, I make better decisions if I don't ask the question. The old question was, hey, where's mine? What's going to happen to me? That whole business is self-centered fear. I'm a pretty disciplined guy in certain ways, but I know that there are some things that don't yield to discipline. I think discipline is the foundation of a spiritual life. If I don't take the time I need to do the praying that I need to do, and that takes a discipline, and on and on, turning off the TV to do the reading at night or to do my 10-step, those are disciplined things. But I can't flog myself into changing. And that's what I used to think I could do. I remember, I was going to quit smoking. Well, it never occurred to me that God would help me do that. Never occurred to me. And so what I did was I decided one day that I was never going to quit smoking. You know, I wasn't going to be one of these, all right, I fail, I go buy 6 more cartons. It wasn't going to happen. Every time I lit a cigarette, I asked God, make this the last cigarette, please. And when I lit another one, I said, make this the last cigarette. And one day it was the last cigarette. And that was it. And that's, I allowed God to do for me what I couldn't do. Okay, and that's the basis of the 7th step. The question of the 7th step is this. What's my goal? And the answer is easy. My goal is perfection. Will I ever get there? Of course not. That's where the humility comes in. The humility comes in because I'll never be perfect. But my goal is to never lie or to mislead another person again. I'll fail, but that's my goal. It isn't to be a better liar or to lie about less important stuff. It's to not lie at all. That's my goal. But I'll fail. But then I'll pick myself up and I'll ask God to forgive me, and I'll ask what corrective measures need to be taken, and then I go on with my life. I want never, ever to ever violate a vow of my marriage. Do I do it? Yes, sometimes I do. Sometimes I'm not as attentive to my wife as I think I need to be. Sometimes I'm more involved in the football game and what it is she's talking about. Yeah, just the way it is. Football is just more exciting a lot of times than marriage. Sorry, I can't help it. It's just that's the nature of football. But you know, I promise to love, to honor, and obey. Am I showing something that's less than loving? Yeah. Then I need to do what I can do to correct that. And what I'll often do is go later and say, Julia, I'm sorry, hon, I was watching the game. I didn't hear everything you had to say. I want to make sure that I know what it is that you want to tell me. And we sit down and talk about it. She'll say, I should know better than to talk to you while you have one ear in the
football game, you know. So she doesn't personalize it, thank goodness. And but do I do that? Of course I do. But my goal is one day to love her perfectly. I'll never do that. But that's my goal.